Hi everyone, and welcome to SciDance Podcast Season 3. I'm your host, Jasmine Cook. This is a dance science podcast presenting discussions with global industry leaders, aiming to make research and information more accessible and enhance dancer well-being, health and training at all levels of the sector. New episodes every Monday, 6 a.m. London time. Hi everyone, and welcome back to SciDance. I'm really excited to be here this morning with Ashley. Ashley began dancing at an early age and trained in the RAD syllabus before going to the University of Calgary for her BA Honours degree in dance with a major in ballet. She danced and performed with a variety of Canadian dance schools before coming to London to study her Master's in Dance Science at Trinity Laban. Since completing her MSc in 2008, Ashley joined the dance department at the University of Roehampton, where she became a senior lecturer and studied for her doctorate. In 2016, she successfully completed her PhD entitled Living with Parkinson's, Does Dance Help Improve the Quality of Movement, Functions and Everyday Activities, which we're going to look at more today. And this research was done in conjunction with the English National Ballet and their Dance for Parkinson's programme. Ashley has also presented research at 4 annual conferences held by the International Association for Dance Medicine and Science and is an iAdams Dance for Health champion, advocating for future work and research in the field. She continues to publish research in the area and is interested in developing new methodologies and approaches to research in the dance for health sector. Welcome, Ashley. It's so great to have you today.
Oh, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. Really, really happy to chat about this research.
So there's obviously your bio just there, but is there anything else you'd add to introduce yourself to our audience? Anything I've missed out?
No, I mean, that's a really nice introduction. It's kind of, it touches on where I've been and my ballet background. But yeah, also where I'm going with my dance science research and the focus now in dance for health, dance for Parkinson's work. And that's where I want to kind of keep going in my future. So I'll talk a little bit about that today.
Amazing. Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your background? So in dance and how you got into dance science, kind of where your interest came from and how you got to where you are now.
Sure. So I've been doing ballet for a very long time. Since I was young, and ended up going to the University of Calgary for their ballet degree. And at the time, that ballet degree was actually in conjunction with the School of Alberta Ballet in Canada, but it was also in conjunction with the kinesiology or sports science department at the university. And I think that was really where my interest in dance science and sports science really was nurtured and started. I met a few colleagues there who really helped me to guide my way in terms of dance science and where I could go to train further. I had heard at the time about a few colleagues who had decided to go and study at Trinity Laban. For their master's degree. And so I followed suit and then heard about that program through my university and came out here in 2007 to study the master's in dance science at Laban. And yeah, ever since then have just fallen in love with it and managed to find jobs within that field. So ended up working at Trinity Laban for a while, working as a graduate assistant there. And through that, was able to get a job lecturing at University of Roehampton. And that has really been my home since finding that job in 2009. I've been there ever since in different capacities. I was a staff member, but then took maternity leave for a while. So I'm back there as a visiting lecturer at the moment. But there I've been lecturing ballet, which is, again, kind of my home base. But then also teaching dance science and material as well. And it's where I got my PhD, which I'll be able to talk a bit more about today as well.
Yeah, definitely. So your research is focused on dance for Parkinson's at English National Ballet. So from what I kind of know from who I've spoken to, I think it's quite a well-known program. Like I think, especially in the UK, most people have heard of it or have some sort of connection with it, or have at least seen it on social media. So, but if we haven't, what's this program? So can you give us a bit of background about it?
Absolutely. Yes, it is a very well-known program. So the Dance for Parkinson's program at English National Ballet started back in 2010, and they were taking inspiration from the Dance for Parkinson's program with the Mark Morris Dance Company in New York. And with that, then they ended up taking on a very similar teaching style and framework and structure to their classes. The classes at English National Ballet happen on a weekly basis, and it's about an hour and a half in length, the classes, and there's always time afterwards for kind of a social time for tea and biscuits and a good chat. And the company repertoire is what the classes are based on. So they the dance artists who teach the classes use as a theme whatever the company is currently rehearsing or performing is generally the theme of what the classes will be looking at. So you've got Romeo and Juliet or Sleeping Beauty or Le Corsaire. And these things are then, of course, tailored to what the participants can do and what they need in the classes. And then from a research point of view, in 2010, when English National Ballet started this program, they got in touch with Dr. Sarah Houston at the University of Roehampton, who then also brought me on board as well onto the research team. And they asked us to research alongside this pilot work that they were doing to evaluate the program, but also look at potential benefits, things that could be happening as a result of the work. So yeah, it was a two-phase project. It finished actually quite a while ago. So it was 2016 when it completed, but the classes are still ongoing, and many of the participants who were part of our research kept dancing afterwards as well. And yeah, you can still sign up and still dance with them, which is wonderful. Yeah.
And then that became your PhD, right? So you went, I think as well, I just want to say that I think the link between the company rep that they're doing and the classes is so special. I think I said that last time we spoke, but I just think it's the most special link.
It's wonderful. Yeah. It's an amazing thing, and I'll talk about this maybe a little bit later on, but the way that they were able to incorporate the company as well, you know, the costume designers would often come and have a chat with the participants as well and talk to them about the costumes. You'd have some of the professional dancers from the company coming down and doing little mini performances with them as well. So it was just a very, just such a rich environment and experience. Yeah,
it's gorgeous. It became your PhD then after 2016. So can you tell us about this transition? How did that happen? And what were your kind of further research questions that you wanted answered?
Absolutely. So yes, it did start as a voluntary project in 2010. And then gradually, so we did a pilot project, and then gradually through that pilot project, some of my colleagues at University of Roehampton kind of hinted towards, you know, if I was already kind of doing this work on a voluntary basis, why not utilize it for a PhD degree if that's something that I was looking to do? And it was. And so we just kind of wrote up the applications and went for it. And what was really great was that obviously Dr. Sarah Houston, at the time she had invited me on board, she was the lead researcher on the project. So she naturally just became one of my supervisors on the PhD. And then also my other supervisor, Professor Raymond Lee, who was working at the time in the life sciences department at Roehampton. He also came on board, and he helped really develop and guide us with some of the methods, particularly the quantitative and biomechanical measurements as well. And, you know, one thing that kind of really developed throughout that time, it was quite interesting because I was doing a PhD, but there was also kind of what I always called the wider English National Ballet project. So there was this artistic project happening, and then alongside it, I was also trying to complete the PhD. And there were certain elements that crossed over, and some things that I really had to develop myself as a researcher doing this thesis work. And one of the main developments that came out of that was a focus on the World Health Organization's it's called the International Classification of Functioning Disability and Health. It's quite a long long name, but it's basically health and health-related domain structure. So it helps us to look at changes at a physical and mental level, and how those changes might then impact ease of everyday activities and participation in society. And I became very interested in looking at all of these different levels of the framework, and not only kind of keying into potential changes to balance or stability for these participants, which is quite a common thing to look at with regards to exercise, dance, and Parkinson's. But I also wanted to then understand how meaningful that was for participants in their everyday lives. You know, not that they were just, you know, going up on a particular scale, but that it was making a difference in how they could do certain things or how they could participate in their community. And that was very much based on this framework. So it's something that developed out of the PhD work that I'm trying to kind of advocate for and continue to work with as I go forward in research, really. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And we can look at some more of those benefits later in the things that you looked at. But if we just go back a few steps, so starting with the pilot study that you did at the very, very start, can you tell us a little bit more about so the structure of the study and the research, but also about the classes, how they ran? And I remember you said you were looking to evaluate the program, but it was really open-ended. So it was kind of just seeing what questions came out. Just tell us a little bit about what, to go alongside what they were already doing. So a little bit about what this first pilot study looked like.
Sure. Yeah. So the first pilot study was quite short, actually. So it was just 12 weeks. And it took place between 2010 and 2011. So just one term of dancing, really. And at the time, the classes were the same structure, as I mentioned. So it was still weekly ballet classes happening at the main studio headquarters, still an hour and a half in length. And I believe the ballet that we were working with for that pilot project was Romeo and Juliet, so which was a lovely piece to start with. So participants, of course, would, within the class, they would learn about the storyline and the characters and the plot and how in a ballet context we would bring that story across on stage. And of course, the material, again, the movement material was modified and worked with the participants that were there and what they could do and what they needed. Generally, the class structure stays relatively the same across all of the terms. The choreography will change depending on the theme that we're looking at, but the main structure stays pretty similar. So you'll generally begin seated in chairs, and they're often in a circular formation. And you'll have the instructor or instructors sitting in the center so that everybody can see them. And the first kind of warm-up material and first half of the class is really based on kind of port-au-bras work. So you'll have lots of movement through the arms, a lot of rotation in the torso, so opening up that movement and mobilizing around the spine, mobilizing different joints. You'll have parts that are looking at exercises where participants are clapping to different rhythms or stamping their feet to different rhythms. So it's that kind of work initially. And then the second half of class is standing, and we move the chairs away. Some of the exercises might be more stationary to begin with. So they might go to the ballet bar and do a plié or a tendu exercise. But then generally we'll get out into the space and we'll do more dynamic work, maybe swaying and transfer of weight. We always, in every Dance for Parkinson's class I've been to, have a time where we walk across the space. So it's encouraging that kind of open walk right from one end of the studio to the other to a nice steady rhythm. And I should say as well, with the English National Ballet classes, we were very, very lucky to be able to have live musicians in the space, which, it goes without saying that that's just, it's a wonderful treat to have. And it was so important for the teachers and the participants. There were little minute changes that could happen instantaneously in terms of the tempo and the rhythm. Things could be adjusted as needed. And that isn't always the case when you're having to work with recorded music. So that was kind of the basic structure of what we would go through. And oftentimes as well, at the end of class, there might be time for creative work as well. So some improvisation and working in partners, perhaps, where a participant would need to mirror the other person's actions and then they would switch. And looking at changes to dynamics and quality of movement there as well. And in terms of the research for that pilot work, yes, I mean, initially, the English National Ballet remit, I guess you could say, was a bit more open-ended. They were looking for us to just look at potential benefit. Of course, us as researchers needed to then narrow down on what then we wanted to focus on. But we also had to do that in a way that was respectful of the artistic project that was taking place. It was very clear that the dance artists were in charge of, as were the live musicians, part of that discussion, the content and the choreography of what would be taking place in the studio. And us as researchers were to come alongside that and observe as best we could what was happening and what was taking place.
Yeah, I think that's such a positive approach. And I think that's really, because I know you, like, we'll speak a little bit later about how that's maybe a limitation, but personally for me, I really see that as such a positive. I think it's like a real world example of how things are happening. We can't always change variables. I think it actually gives like such good insight as well. I love hearing like a little bit of insight into how the classes run. I think that's so special. And yeah, it really opens it up. It's really lovely. So you were looking at more of the physical side and Sarah was focusing on more kind of interviews and qualitative data, right?
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So what kind of methods were used in each of these? And then also, I'm kind of curious, just more anecdotally, what was it like working with this population? So I guess, yeah, like speaking to them, what did you find out that maybe wasn't necessarily part of your methods and results, but how did you find it personally?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, working with this population was just, I mean, it was so special. And I think it really taught me a lot about the kind of researcher that I want to be. And as I go into the field, I think, you know, sometimes I think maybe initially I was an early career researcher, I guess you could say. You know, obviously in the process of doing my PhD, I hadn't done a lot of work like this previously. And so I had gone in with my kind of science hat, you know, thinking about how I could measure change. And what I really was so grateful for was this experience of getting to know participants. And again, I'll come back maybe to this a little bit later on, and how this works in a scientific way, because not all scientific projects allow for this researcher participant relationship. But of course, in the context of our project that was there, and I got to talk with the participants a lot. I got to know them very well. I got to talk about why dance was meaningful to them, why they came and attended. And also through those conversations, I got to know the individual, not just as a number, you know, not just as one of the numbers on my spreadsheet to look for change in some sort of physical way. I got to know these people and the different contextual factors that shape them, that shape their lives, and how dance then fits into that. So I think that whole experience really shifted the way that I will approach research in the future and really helped me understand the value of a more person-centered approach as well. So it was, yeah, life-changing, as I say. But yeah, and in terms of the methods, so yes, Sarah was focusing more on the qualitative aspects of the project. So she focused more on carrying out interviews, semi-structured interviews, focus group discussions. Participants also were asked to keep a diary of their experiences of the dancing. And we also, as I say, we attended the sessions. So we did get to observe and take part in those dance classes. And in doing so, we also filmed the work as well. So we looked back at observational analysis. And from a quantitative point of view, I focused more on changes to balance and also changes to posture. And I did this, the way that I looked at it was, for balance, we used something called the Fullerton Advanced Balance Scale. So it's a clinical rating scale with participants asked to do various tasks, looking at how stable they can be in those tasks. And then I also looked at changes to posture. So I looked at this using 2D motion analysis and just capturing images of them standing front facing and side facing. And I looked at changes in terms of how they were standing and the angles between various points on their plumb line. And also I think, you know, throughout this, it was constantly going back to the film and constantly going back to our notes from class and noting changes that we were also seeing in terms of their movement ability, in class itself.
Yeah, that's great. Can we look at, so we come back to later, can we look a little bit about the kind of scientific aspect of it and the relationship with the participants? So obviously you said it's different to most other intervention studies because it's a pre-existing setup and you're coming in from the outside as researchers, and you don't have the same control that other research teams might have had kind of otherwise. So can you tell us some more about how this did influence the study? And I guess there's maybe limitations in applicability, some might say, from Absolutely. A scientific point of view, which there's pros and cons. So could you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I've found so interesting throughout my process with this project. And so it was the same, I mean, with both, this is particularly the first phase of the project that I'm talking about at the moment, but it was the same in the second phase as well. This idea that we as researchers were coming in to observe an already existing Dance for Parkinson's class. So obviously in normal research, you might see that the dancing is starting because of the research. So the research team puts together a study and then the dancing commences at the exact same time that the research commences. And then oftentimes you might see that the dancing might stop as soon as the research stops. And this was very different. There was something happening in English National Ballet anyways, and that would have gone on with or without us. It just so happened that they wanted us to come and try to observe what was happening. So in terms of things like class content, class frequency, so how many times a week these participants were dancing, we, the research team, did not have control over those variables. And we also, we didn't have control, certainly from the second phase of the project, which I'll talk about in a bit. We ended up bringing in a control group for that project, for that phase of the project. And initially in the pilot project, we did not. So the pilot project was an uncontrolled, very small study, very small sample size. And we just looked at changes that we thought were taking place or that we could see taking place within the dancing participants themselves. But of course, when you're brought in alongside a project that's already existing, you can't randomize groups. There's already a set group there dancing, so you're having to bring in a control group if you want that to take place. And also, you know, we felt quite strongly as researchers that we wanted to take part as embedded researchers. We wanted to be a part of this. And I think that maybe comes from our understanding of the dance space. Both of us are dancers first, really. That we understood in order to actually truly embrace and understand what's taking place, we needed to be there too. We needed to experience it too, and not just objectively, you know, say what was happening for these participants, but feel what was happening as well. And so that was really important. But of course, by way of doing that, it meant that we were not blinded. So we were not randomized. We were not blinded. We understood who were the participants that were dancing and who weren't dancing in that second phase of the project. And so these elements, of course, it makes the research design very different from other research that's often done. And then, of course, when it comes time to publish this research or to get this information out there, you may come up against obstacles. And certainly we did, because we weren't fitting the mold that I think scientific, rigorous research wanted us to fit into. And that was quite difficult because I think there's still quite a lot of important information there that we found. And we wanted to share that as much as possible with a wide range of fields. But when you're not able to kind of match that randomized controlled trial gold standard, it can be quite difficult.
Yeah, definitely. Can you tell us some more about the results of the study then? So both of them, all the two?
Sure.
First phase.
Yeah, I know, there's quite a few. So there is just two phases. So the first, yes, absolutely. So the first pilot project, when we looked at the qualitative and the quantitative and also the observational work as well. Again, this was small. It was just across a 12-week time period, again, uncontrolled. So we had a very small sample size. Quantitatively, we did see some changes on the balance scale and on the postural analysis for some participants, but not for others. Of course, given the small sample size, it wasn't appropriate to do statistical analysis. So in that sense, it really was a pilot project, but we did see some change. We observationally, it was very interesting, and I can come back to this a little bit later as well, but there's a lot that we see in the dance class and that the dance artists see. And frankly, there's a lot that participants see of each other as well. And we noted that in the interviews, that oftentimes participants comment on the miraculous changes that they see in their own peers who are in the class. There's a lot happening observationally, and I find it interesting that quantitatively in the biomechanical measurements, we may not see that matching as much. But certainly from an observational point of view, people were noting a change in fluency of movement and mobility. People were more mobile and more efficient with their movement. People were noting actually changes that they were seeing in the loosening of the torso. So we saw lots of more range of motion, I would say, in the torso and around the spine. There were lots of participants that were able to move more freely around their body. An ability to express and emote and project also changed across the time. So those with Parkinson's often, as you progress in the stages, one of the symptoms that can develop is a difficulty with things like facial expression, vocal expression. These kind of things tend to drift away and they're not so clear. So when you're working with an art form that is so expressive and that encourages participants to take on strong character roles and to emote that and to express those things, the change in the ability of participants to be able to do that was quite miraculous. And even the change in their dynamics and in their choice of movement was clear. And then Sarah in the interviews found some really wonderful, you know, wonderful information, you know, participants finding this work hugely meaningful to them. But I think a large part of that as well is an emphasis on group bonding and, you know, finding that that was a key motivator to coming to the classes, that they enjoyed being around other people, but in a positive way, in a positive atmosphere, where they were learning and developing and accomplishing. There was certainly a noting of improvement in their own symptoms and in their balance and their stability, which was interesting because even if some symptoms were decreasing, participants still noted a perceived change in improvement. So if we were still seeing on the quantitative scales not much happening, they perceived that things were improving. And there was that perceived kind of sense of well-being and that the dancing was doing them good. So again, very interesting things came out of that. So yeah, that was the pilot work. Of course, small in itself, but it did lead to the company wanting us to develop that research more, and it led to a funded longitudinal study, which was great.
Yeah, definitely. Can you tell us, I'm kind of curious, I don't know if you can, because obviously like data has to be anonymous and things like that, but was there anything from the qualitative side that was particularly kind of enlightening? I don't know if you've got any specific examples that you could share with us. I just think it's really interesting to hear what they were
saying. Yeah, I mean, I do have some quotes. Now this is from the second phase. So is it okay if I talk about the second phase of the project and then I'll talk about those quotes as well. Because it was more from the second phase that I've got some quotes written down actually. And that second phase was that longitudinal study that then developed after that. So it took place between 2012 and 2016. So the second phase of the project, again, we were, you know, focusing on a mixed methods approach. So Sarah continued to look at, and actually I did as well as part of my PhD, look at some qualitative work as well and carried out semi-structured interviews, focus group discussions. Participants again kept diaries of their experiences with Parkinson's, dancing with Parkinson's. We attended the sessions as well again and filmed those sessions as well and looked at observational analysis. And then for me, the quantitative aspects, I wanted to go a bit deeper with these and understand a bit more about dynamic stability, so changes to dynamic stability. I was interested also in, because of the work that we did in the pilot project, which found this kind of loosening of the torso and more rotation around the spine, I was quite interested in that because people with Parkinson's tend to have issues with rigidity in their muscles and everything can become quite tight. And so I was very interested in this change that was happening potentially as a result of this kind of port de bras work and a lot of the rotation that they were doing in those seated exercises as well as the standing exercises. So I wanted to look at that as well. So I did some biomechanical work looking at changes in dynamic stability, but also in trunk coordination and trunk range of motion during walking. And we also looked a little bit deeper at changes to the severity of Parkinson's symptoms across the duration of the project. And we looked at changes to quality of life and also to balance confidence as well. We did a scale that utilized a scale called the activity-specific balance confidence scale. And this one helped us to understand changes to how confident people were that they could remain stable in various different situations. We thought it would be quite interesting to see if they were gaining confidence in their stability and in their ability to stay upright. And so we looked at all of those things as well. And across this time, what we found was very interesting. So with the results on that, quantitatively, we did not see much change. Across time. So quantitatively it was approximately just over 2 years that we did the quantitative measurements. And I should say that those measurements were taken at the beginning of the project and then every 3 months until the end of the project. So every term of dancing, we basically got information. But the qualitative work, the discussions with participants and interviews, that just happened throughout the entire project. So there weren't specific times. It was kind of constantly happening where we would schedule in these discussions. So quantitatively, we did not see much change on a statistical level. When we grouped the participants together, of course, we had a control group, as I mentioned. The control group were people with Parkinson's who were not dancing at all, and we recruited them specifically just for testing sessions, basically. And we didn't see any change across time. We didn't see any difference between the control and the dancing group across the two-year span. We did, however, see some clinically meaningful change on an individual level. So some individuals did improve. It's just that when they were pooled together on a statistical analysis, that change was lost and flatlined, and it didn't come out. But if you were to look at an individual case study situation, you would see some great improvement for some people. So there you go. An interesting point. So then the observational analysis, similar situation to the pilot study, where we were constantly seeing improvements. And again, participants were noting that as well in the interviews as well, that they were noting a change in fluency. Our comments and our things that we noted also mimic what other studies have shown in Dance for Parkinson's, whereby, you know, participants will come in potentially needing a walking aid and struggling with their gait. And then all of a sudden at the end of class, they might leave the class even forgetting that they had a walking aid in the first place and walk out of the space, you know, just with a huge amount of confidence and ability. That truly is miraculous. And when you're watching that happen, it's all a researcher wants to do, is to be able to, you know, kind of show that in the research, that, you know, in a meaningful way, that this is happening and that this is taking place. And how do we show that? But that was amazing. And then, you know, so qualitatively, there were numerous things that we found. I mean, that's really where I think the gem of this research is. It really showed how meaningful it was for participants. Again, coming back to the emphasis on group bonding, on participants recalling that they felt a sense of gracefulness with their movement, a sense of beauty that was so important to them, because honestly, with Parkinson's, that is often lost, that that joyful movement and that emphasis on what my body can still do is often taken away with Parkinson's. And so to bring that back and to focus on my body in a positive way was quite important for them, I think, and that was really meaningful. And again, even if we weren't seeing the quantitative measurements spike up and show improvement, there was this perceived improvement. There was this perceived change that was happening, whereby they would say, I can't necessarily say for certain what is changing, but I feel better in myself. Even if the quantitative measurements aren't showing it, there's a sense of well-being that's coming from this. So it was very, very interesting results. So I do have a few quotes, actually, just some things that I thought would be, and there's a few of them particularly that I keep coming back to, because I think there's something there that is important for future research. So one of the participants says, can I add, I've identified about 8 or 10 words to describe what we're doing. Imagination, creativity, language, color, music, rhythm. And I've not come across anything in my diverse life which combines all those things. The breadth and depth of what is going on downstairs in the studio is significant. End quote. So that is just beautiful. There's just something there that's just so important. And as he says, this kind of this range of things that are taking place, it's quite specific and unique to a dance intervention, you know, aside from other kinds of activities that one might do. Another quote from a participant, it's not just I'm in the mood, but physically I feel different. I don't think about it all the time, but suddenly I realize how much better I feel. More movement, more energy, certainly more energized. I want to stay positive and not think about Parkinson's. End quote. And just one more. My attitude towards myself has changed. This is so welcoming and a non-judgmental sort of atmosphere of welcoming and acceptance, me learning and possibilities. Here we are crooked and falling over and we're allowed to do it. End quote. Yeah, so I just think, you know, there's something there with that, with some of the quotes and some of the things that were coming out of that material that I'm interested in, you know, kind of picking apart for future research, because I think there is this kind of different atmosphere in a dance class versus maybe other exercise interventions or other ways that we might help people with Parkinson's. Dance has this other layer to it, this artistic layer. It was an artistic and cultural endeavor, of course, but I think the atmosphere, and as this participant rightly says, this non-judgmental place where it's not about their Parkinson's. It really isn't. It's interesting because it's called Dance for Parkinson's, yes, but the way that the classes are approached are not, they're not about the Parkinson's. You're not coming in and sitting down and talking about what the Parkinson's is ridding them of, or what they can't do anymore, or you know, what the side effects of these medications that they have to take are. This kind of talk isn't part of it. It's not there. It's not treating them as patients who need fixing. It's come on in and learn about ballet and, you know, just take part and let's move together. And that's really cool. And it's really positive. And I think people really appreciated that positivity because it encouraged them to really focus on accomplishing and what they could still do rather than what the Parkinson's was taking away. So really important. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, there's so many things there that I'd love to pick out. I don't know which way to go first. I'm going to start. Yeah. I don't know if this is a little bit dull, but there's other things I want to look after. But I'm just really interested kind of personally. So statistically, how does that work then? If you can see changes in some participants, but when you put it all together, you can't. Like, why is that? Why does it come out like that?
Oh, it's so interesting. So one of the things that was a part of this research, going back to the results, I mean, there's certainly a variety of reasons why we may have seen what we did, or indeed not saw the change, because we didn't, in the longitudinal study, we didn't see that kind of statistical change. There's a multitude of reasons for that. From a scientific point of view, I can say certainly that we would know that if we're trying to implement change, physical change, you know, developing strength, coordination, balance, what have you, whatever that component of fitness, one needs a certain amount of overload on the system in order to see change. So an overload can come in a variety of different ways. You might need to increase the intensity, increase the frequency of how often you're doing it. And I think many of us know that if we don't do that and we just end up doing the same level of intensity and the same frequency over a long period of time of any exercise, we might plateau on certain fitness components. And so I think that's one of the main reasons why we didn't see change was that, you know, participants were a part of a very meaningful experience. But from a physical point of view, when it comes to things like changes to gait patterns and stability, they were dancing, many of them, just once a week. Yeah, so that these classes specifically were just once a week over the long period of time. And in terms of intensity, that did not necessarily change. The classes didn't grow in intensity. They may have changed in terms of content and choreography, but that choreography didn't necessarily grow more intense. So, you know, participants weren't necessarily being challenged on a physical level across the long period. And so the lack of quantitative change actually kind of makes sense. But also one thing that happened was, as part of the research, it was very inclusive. So we had people taking part who were perhaps stage one of their condition and very early Parkinson's. And we had others who were stage four and five, who were quite severely disabled with the Parkinson's symptoms. So then you have quite a high variability in the data set, because some are quite able and moving quite well, and others not so much. And so when you put such high variability in that data into the statistical analysis, you end up having this really kind of stretched out situation when you're looking at the numbers. And I think from an individual point of view, when you put just one individual into that huge pot of high variability data, the statistical analysis just didn't pick it up because there was just too much spread. And also, I mean, from a scientific point of view as well, it was fairly small sample size. I mean, we were still dealing with somewhere on any given measurement, somewhere between 15 and 25 participants. So clearly statistical analysis, when you have hundreds of participants, works quite well maybe to pick up things. When you have quite a small sample size and that sample size has a high variability, it becomes very challenging to see the individual change. And so one of the things that I did in my PhD was say, okay, I don't think statistical analysis is really working. I reported it and I included it in the thesis and I included it in the reports because I think oftentimes that's what people want to see. They want to see numbers. They want to see the stats. But I, in my PhD, also really valued the case study approach and just saying, okay, scrap the statistics. Let's start talking about each individual and what happened. And perhaps, and also very interesting, and part of the framework that I was talking about earlier, the World Health Organization's framework. One part of that framework is to really try to consider and take into account contextual factors, so personal, environmental contextual factors that may play a role in why the results came out the way that they did. So for instance, for one particular participant, there could be a range of things. We had people taking part in the dancing who lost a loved one across that term. We had people who had a multitude of other health conditions that they were dealing with alongside the Parkinson's, loads of different things like that. We had people who were taking part who had other family issues or had to be away for a certain period of time. There's just so many different factors. And what's interesting to me is how and if those contextual factors are truly considered in other research projects. Because what I've realized during this project was I need to account for these because they are making a difference to the results, I think. And the only way that I can account for it is to look at case studies. But when we pool everybody into statistical analysis, all of that contextual stuff just kind of goes out the window and we don't consider it. But how could we not consider it if it might be impacting the results? I don't know, some big questions.
Huge questions, yeah, but that makes so much more sense. So thank you so much for explaining it. I love doing this because I learn as well. So yeah, thank you for explaining it. Another thing I want to look at from that is about kind of the mixed methods. So I was thinking as you were talking then, by looking at kind of qualitative and quantitative aspects of it, that kind of mirrors the holistic nature of dance. I don't know, is that a stretch? Mm. It makes sense in my head that you're looking at sure. aspects there and then all the expressive and movement and physical kind of aspects of dance as well. So could you tell us a bit more about how a mixed methods kind of study was really, really useful? And then I don't know if that links in as well to the nature of the classes being company classes with rep and artistic kind of aspects too.
Oh, I think it does, absolutely. I mean, so we were, one of the aims of this research was to look at change, but not just change on a physical level, which frankly, at the time of the research was really where most of the research was focusing, was just on the physical change. How can dance help physical things like balance? For instance, balance being one of the ones that's focused on a lot. And then not only that, much of the research was focusing on only the quantitative, only the physical, and not necessarily how those physical changes were impacting the individual in their everyday lives, just that it changed on a balance scale. So there was so much that we felt was missing in terms of the depth of what we could talk about and how dance could potentially be useful or impacting individuals. And we wanted to look at this full kind of how is dance impacting on physical, mental, emotional, and social levels as well, to get a more kind of broader understanding of how this was impacting and why it was meaningful for participants. Why did they keep coming, and what was the key reason, what were the key aims that these individuals had? I do think that this is something that I'm really interested in going forward with. I think mixed methods approaches are so useful. I think that this is maybe where we continue to work. I'm still thinking about where future research methods needs to focus. I think from a mixed methods point of view, what was really important for us that we were able to discuss what was happening on a variety of different levels. So if we had just focused on quantitative change and physical change, there wouldn't have been much to tell. If from this research, unfortunately, the quantitative results didn't pick up much change, but we ourselves know from observing the classes subjectively, and also from carrying out qualitative analysis, that there was huge benefit and that there was huge perceived change and that there was huge change. It's just that our quantitative measurements weren't necessarily the right ones to pick that up. So I think from a mixed methods approach, I think what was hugely important for us was that we were able to tell more of the story by looking at things from different angles and not just focusing solely on one thing. But I also think in future research, perhaps where we need to go as well and to focus on is why are participants coming and what do they value? I mean, from what I can see, research has been focusing quite heavily on changes to health components. So things like balance to reduce fall risk. Now, that's not to say that that's not important. That's hugely important. But participants also engage with dance for a variety of reasons outside of the fact that it might help change their balance. They're participating largely because it is an artistic and cultural experience, right? And they clearly, from the results we can see, are engaging because of the group that they are moving with and that they're dancing with, and because the environment is non-judgmental and because it welcomes them in, and it's a time where they don't focus on their Parkinson's. So if that's the case, what is the other layer that dancing is providing? Yes, it could be seen as an exercise form, because it is, they're exercising, they're moving, but there's something else taking place. There's something else, and there's more to the story than just the movement and the change physically. I think the artistic nature of the work that they were doing with the company, I think it really changed the way that they were interacting with ballet. They were immersed in a professional company. I mean, that's an amazing part of this project was, being right there. I mean, even the space that they were working in was the main company studio headquarters. So they were immersed in this company's work. They were seeing the dancers. We were going to the theater as well with the participants, and they were seeing what they were doing in the studio. They were seeing on stage as well. So I think, from that perspective as well, and I come back to this idea of it wasn't just to come in and, move their score on a particular scale, a certain amount of numbers. They were coming to experience something, and they were coming to learn about something. And I think that that's really important. And I think future research should maybe think about looking first at why participants come, and then perhaps developing research questions from there, from the participant perspective. That would be interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And that's exactly what I was going to ask about next, actually. So obviously, you've got to kind of look at why the participants come to find the research questions from that. And I loved when you were speaking about how the classes and they allow the participants to value what their body can do instead of what it can't do, which forms sort of a change for them. So research maybe hasn't fully evidenced or articulated what's happening in this kind of space yet. How do you think it might do that in the future?
That's a very good question. It's definitely what I want, what I'm trying to focus on now. I know recent research, particularly there was a systematic review that was done recently with I think it was University of Exeter and Trinity Laban, and there were a few other people involved in that project. And reading the report from this systematic review, which looked at dance and the value of different arts-based therapies, and one of the things that they were calling for was a new approach to research, or perhaps looking at how we are approaching this work and the methods that we're using. Because while there is a need for rigorous research, of course there is, you know, it needs to be detailed. We need to be writing out in our research exactly what's happening in these dance classes. We need to be very specific about our methods so that it's replicable. Our methods, of course, as ever, need to be rigorous, but we are also dealing with a very subjective situation, a subjective art form. So herein lies that language barrier that I feel needs to be worked on. There's somewhat of a language barrier between what dance artists are doing in the space and what the science medical field say is rigorous research and what is needed in order to evidence change, value, what have you. So I feel like there is a need to, and I know other colleagues in the dance for health field as well, feel that there is a need to kind of break down these language barriers and talk to each other about what's going on in the dance space and what is needed from a research point of view, and how we can marry these two together for future research, and how we can work together to find ways of bringing about research that hits home on a scientific medical point of view, but that also respects the artistic environment that this is happening in and the artistic art form itself. And I'm curious, I don't know, and that's kind of where I'm going with my research. I don't really know what the right answer is at the moment, but I have an inkling that I think what's important for now is also incorporating the participants in this discussion. And I think one of the reasons perhaps why our research, not maybe one of the reasons why we didn't see change, because I think, as I mentioned before, I think a lot of it comes down to the overload and the fact that they were only dancing once a week over a long period of time. And perhaps there was a plateau for those physical measurements. But I think something that's really interesting that I've realized is that, you know, going into that research, in terms of the quantitative measurements, we made decisions early on about what we wanted to look at. And we made those decisions, I think, primarily because of what previous research was looking at. And also, we know that things like balance and fluidity in the torso are important for everyday lives and for moving. Right? So it's, obviously, there's significance there. But I think that I would like future research to then look more closely at why participants are there in the first place, and then possibly forming that research out of that, and having research that's a bit more meaningful then for the participants who are actually doing it, and not just to key into terms that we ourselves think are important from a research objective point of view, but to you know, really draw in the participants into this discussion and say, what's important for you? Why are you here? What would you like to see in the research? And let's maybe go from there and talk about different ways that we can approach this work.
Yeah, definitely. That's such a great answer, Ashley. It's been like so great chatting to you today. I'm enjoying this so, so much. I've just got one more thing I'd love to ask you about. So for future applications of this work, there's kind of I think you mentioned there's a bit of a push to try and get it more into a healthcare community, because that's where this sort of thing could be, I don't know if prescribed is quite the right word, where you could kind of apply it. So do you think that this is the most effective way to reach further kind of real world applications of the work, or how else do you hope that this research might be utilized?
It's a really great question. There is a push right now in the Dance for Health field for this, and lots of work being done to, as I say, break down those language barriers, I think, and talk to healthcare providers and public health services to understand what benchmarking things are needed on their side in order for us to show dancing is meeting those criteria in order to be prescribed, just as physiotherapy would be prescribed for an individual, can dance be prescribed for an individual in that way? I think that that's a hugely important avenue, and I think that that's needed. I think there are other applications. Frankly, I think because I've been there and seen how meaningful and how important it is for these participants to be doing it and that they love it so much, I think there's a real awareness amongst the Dance for Parkinson's researchers and artists that are teaching this work that we just need more of it. We need more opportunity for people to do it. We need more funding for classes to actually be taking place. So I think it's an awareness thing for me from a research point of view as well, drawing awareness to the benefit of it. And not only on a physical level, but the wider aspect of what dance can bring somebody's life over and above just physical benefit. But I think also, you know, drawing in funders and money. And I mean, unfortunately, just, you know, that is one of the things that is needed in order for classes to take place and community halls to be rented out and all of these things, is that, you know, we need support. And so I think, you know, in future research, it is about just getting more people aware and more people involved as well, and allowing for opportunities for this work to exist. And for that to happen, we need to have those conversations with funders, with stakeholders, to understand what they need as evidence, and how we can marry those two worlds together to actually give them that evidence to then fund this beautiful work that takes place and allow more and more people to do it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to look at all the kind of potential avenues for application, because I hadn't, like, that wouldn't have really crossed my mind that it would be something that could be prescribed in that way. So it's really interesting. Honestly, I can't tell you how great it's been to talk to you today. I haven't covered anything like this before, really, I don't think. And yeah, I've learned so much, and I just love the way you speak so beautifully about it. Is there anything else you'd like to mention or discuss today?
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure, you know, talking about the research. I could literally talk for hours about this stuff. You know, I just am so interested in it. And I think I've talked about all the different places that you know, that I'm thinking future research should go after this. And though my kind of home base has been Dance for Parkinson's, I'm looking more broadly now at Dance for Health and how all of these things can potentially connect to dance for other populations as well. Dance for dementia, dance for MS, dance for older adults and younger children. So I think it should be an exciting time as we go out there and look at different ways and approaches to this work.
Oh my gosh, definitely. Yeah, and I'm so excited to see where it goes. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you, Jasmine.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in again next Monday. And in the meantime, follow at SciDance Podcast on Instagram. It would also be so appreciated if you have a moment, if you could please rate and review on Apple to help the podcast grow. Bye.